calling the Hodges versus State case 74515. I would ask both sides to please, for my clerk, state your names and your co-counsel. And actually, Mr. Waters, I know both of you, both sides, but can you tell us how much time you'll need for rebuttal?
Yeah, sure. I need 5 minutes,
Your Honor. Okay, that'll be the order. Whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thanks. Good afternoon. My name is William Waters. I'm an attorney at the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Andrew Hodges. With me today is Seth Gutierrez. He was one of the trial attorneys. Mr. Henry, Alex Henry, was the other trial attorney. He's on family leave, so he could not be here today. So in Mr. Hodges' case, this was not a whodunit. Obviously, Mr. Hodges did something that day. And so because this was not a whodunit, the defense that Mr. Hodges wanted to present was that he committed certain crimes, not necessarily the ones that the state had charged him with, but other crimes. And then through cross-examining the police officers, he was essentially trying to set up the argument later in trial that he should be entitled to some lesser-included offenses and theory of defense instructions. So the issues kind of naturally sort of blend into each other. The first issue is obviously, you know, what is a defendant allowed to elicit from certain witnesses regarding, well, police officer witnesses regarding the defendant's behavior? Now, in this case, to be clear, Mr. Hodges was never asking the police officers to offer an opinion on Mr. Hodges' guilt for not only the charges that he was, or the crimes that he was charged with. They weren't asking him to offer an opinion as to his guilt on any crimes whatsoever. What they were trying to establish was that certain, through investigative procedures, the police officers involved in the investigation developed facts that they believe lent itself to charges which the state ultimately either didn't charge or charged in a greater degree.
But then, Mr. Water,
Yes.
Mr. Water, then isn't that exactly the inference that you're asking the jury to draw from that evidence, is the officer's opinion about what offenses were committed?
I think that would certainly be improper for them to say, you know, you heard the police officer say he's of the opinion that this was, but, and I know I'm trying to draw a fine line. I presume that's not what their intention was. Their intention was, as Mr. Gutierrez said at trial, was to show that, you know, given the same set of facts, an independent observer can, or two different independent observers can come to reasonable differences of opinion as to what actually occurred. It just so happened that with respect to the robbery involving the alleged robbery involving the van, the witnesses who had some of the more relevant information were the police officers. I think there were four witnesses to that, but the two lay witnesses actually didn't see the incident happen. So when you don't necessarily, when you have Mr. Fay, who's the only, I guess, witness who could testify as to his position as to what happened, you know, Mr. Gutierrez and Mr. Henry were trying to kind of demonstrate that merely because someone says something happened to them, that shouldn't be enough. Quite frankly, one of the reasons we have police officers who diligently investigate is so that, you know, you don't go to trial just based on an allegation. I mean, their position was that the evidence didn't support the robbery, that the only evidence that sort of...
But Mr. Waters, the jury clearly disagreed with that. And it wasn't just Mr. Fay. There was a bus driver who was at a vantage point to observe the entire incident. As I recall, there was a video of the incident and other witnesses. So I still wanted to circle back to where you started. Is what's the relevance of the offense that he was arrested for when the officer doesn't have a charging decision? It's the DA's discretion to charge how they will, and they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt those offenses. How is it relevant?
A couple of things. I think part of what they were trying to get at was I guess, submitted charges or charges that weren't submitted. That's one thing. But I do think that Mr. Gutierrez was also trying to elicit sort of testimony regarding, like, investigative procedures. Now, so let me separate those two. I think we can all agree that you can certainly question a police officer as to what he did, who he interviewed, what he learned through that investigation. Now, with respect to the other issue, which is, well, what charges were submitted or what charges weren't submitted, I mean, it's as relevant as, you know, I guess a witness or an alleged victim saying, this guy robbed me.
Well, Mr. Waters, would it be equally as relevant then if the DA charges according to the officer's proposed or arrested charges and the officer then gets to testify? That's what I thought it was. I agree. I think he's guilty of these offenses or sufficient to arrest. Why do we care what the officer arrested him for?
Well, because in a case where it's not a whodunit and you have to present a defense, because obviously, you know, you can't stand up there and say, hey, my client's guilty of everything. And if the defense is that he committed some crimes but not the ones necessarily that the state charged, now the police officer, I think the law is pretty clear. They can't say that, you know, I am of the opinion that he committed X, Y, and Z. But this court has also been very clear that police officers can testify that in a way that creates an inference that the police officer believes that the defendant committed some crimes.
In this case, though, I mean, it's not as if he was originally charged with grand larceny auto and the DA went and recharged it as a robbery, where perhaps questioning might be more relevant as to why the police officer took certain action for probable cause purposes if he had been arrested for that. But here, when you're asking hypotheticals, how can that be relevant?
Well, it was either the TCR or the arrest report, there was grand larceny auto. I believe that was one of the charges that the police officer determined that was probably committed. Well, that's obviously relevant because later he's asking for grand larceny auto as a theory of defense instruction. So I guess he has to establish that there's evidence that that's what happened. And then one of the other ones was they charged him with burglary, but I guess the police officer didn't arrest him for burglary. Well, I mean, that's important as well because it goes to, you know, look, we talked to witnesses, we reviewed this, we reviewed that, you know, and based on all that, you know, we felt we weren't going to book him in on a burglary at that time. I understand that this is a fine line, but I do think that in certain cases when the defense is I committed some crimes but not the crimes I'm charged with, sometimes you got to go down that road. And I think as long as you don't cross the line, which is, you know, what's your opinion as to whether he did this or not, you know, I think, and it might not be the greatest strategy and it might not be the greatest defense, but sometimes that's the defense that's all we have.
Mr. Water, I wonder if you could shift gears, if you don't mind, to a different subject.
Sure.
I'd like you to address your client's position with respect to the testimony that was taken by audio-visual method and whether there was a constitutional violation. Excuse me, wrong case. Wrong question.
You scared me for a second.
Would you care to address this in a different case? My apologies. I was looking at a different note. Wrong case. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Water, while you're drinking, I'd like you to address the closing arguments and the alleged errors as they relate to the multiple uses of maniac to describe the defendant and his behavior. And certainly some were okay, too, some weren't, but give me kind of the thrust of your argument here.
So there was repeated references to Mr. Hodges as a maniac and a menace. And I will agree with the state that those were not objected to, so that error was not preserved. Nevertheless, I guess the state could have made its argument that, quite frankly, I don't even know what that was relevant for, the fact that he, you know, acted maniacally or was menacing. I mean, the, I guess the robbery charge would have been, I guess, because there's an element of threat of force there, that maybe his behavior in that respect could be relevant to that. But the problem is the argument was in relation to him driving the car. So any alleged robbery, I guess, was over at that point. Now he's got the car and he's driving down the street. So the references were, you know, he drove like a maniac. He was a menace. He had zero regard for the safety of the people in the community. I mean, I think that inflammatory language is pretty clearly prosecutorial misconduct, because there's the only point of it is to inflame the passions of the jury by, I guess, suggesting to them that, you know, this kind of behavior with this type of person can't be tolerated in the community because it endangers the safety of all of us. I've got 4 minutes. I'm gonna finish on this point if that's okay. So there was no objection. I understand that. Nevertheless, there's two things. Like, you can either review for plain error, and I do think that it's plain from the record. And I do think it affected a substantial right to a fair trial because it goes to the very heart of you know, notions of fairness and due process. Like, we're not prosecuted because of you know, based on what the district attorney thinks our behavior is. We're prosecuted based on our actions. Or number two, I think that sometimes in this court's law, case law is very clear that if prosecutorial misconduct is such that it's so patently prejudicial and obvious, then the court has a sua sponte obligation to step in. And so I think this would certainly qualify as that. And so under either standard, if your honors find that the court had a sua sponte obligation to step in and say, cut this out, it's reversible. I think that even if you apply plain error, because there was no objection, I do think that it affected Mr. Hodges' fundamental right to a fair trial. And so with that, I will save the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Waters. From the state?
Good afternoon, Justices. Colleen Baharov for the state of Nevada. May it please the court. One of the issues raised by counsel during his opening statements to you all was whether or not the defense specifically should have the ability to question officers regarding the charges that they believe are appropriate when they arrest a person after the commission of a crime. The state submits to your honors, as I believe Justice Stiglitz pointed out, the state is the ultimate charging authority. In this case, one of the officers had 10 months of experience and was still under field training at the time he was asked questions about what charges they thought were appropriate. But even if he had more experience, as the second officer did, whether or not at the time of this particular incident they arrested that individual for charges the state ultimately decided to proceed on is not relevant to whether or not he was guilty of the charges the state actually proceeded on. And the defense was not precluded from arguing that the state failed to meet its burden on the charged offenses. And in fact, I believe I personally indicated at the time when we were arguing these instructions that they could argue that all day. The state didn't charge a person with that crime. Maybe he was guilty of that crime. And since we haven't charged him with that and we didn't prove what we did charge him with, he's just not guilty, period. So I would submit to your honors that based upon the charging authority in this state, the statutory authority making the state itself the final charging authority, that questioning an officer about possible charges would not have been relevant. Now, moving to the second issue which you addressed, which I believe is the third issue in the briefs, the closing arguments and the comments made by my co-counsel, Mr. Alexis. Mr. Alexis was discussing that those words, maniac, maniacal, in the
context. Would you admit that's misconduct to call the defendant a maniac? And how would you distinguish that from Jones versus State?
I distinguish it in this particular case, Your Honor, because he wasn't calling the defendant himself a maniac or maniacal. He was discussing the driving behavior, which was visible on the videos. Not just the video from leaving the stratosphere, but also the video running the red light by the SLS.
So he made an analogy, is what you're saying?
I am saying that. I am.
Well, that's the same thing in Jones versus State. An analogy was made of how the defendant behaved.
Yes.
And how would you distinguish it? Because our Supreme Court had stated that that was error.
And
to disparage and inflame a jury.
agree that that statement, I can't stand up here and tell you that that statement can't possibly inflame a jury, and I won't do that. But what I will tell your honors is that in the way that it came out at trial, he wasn't telling the jury that the defendant was a maniac and they should convict him because of that. He was analogizing the driving behavior to maniac behavior. But even if this court does find that that was error and inflammatory, the second part of that standard is whether or not it so infected the proceedings with constitutional error such that he's required to have a new trial. And I would submit to your honors that this comment itself does not rise to that level. There was video evidence, as I believe counsel presented to the court through the transmission of an exhibit. The video evidence demonstrated the entirety of this crime. This trial was on video. The whole trial was on video, which is rare, honestly, for the state of Nevada to have all of the charges that we've alleged be present on a video. Over and above that, there was corroborative evidence from witnesses in person. Those witnesses each indicated separately that the defendant used force or violence upon the person of Mr. Fay, took the vehicle by force or violence, took off in that vehicle erratically, and Mr. McKinney himself indicated that the defendant drove Mr. Fay's vehicle right at him. So that, again, was related to the driving behavior. Ms. Lopez testified that the defendant was driving. Well, she couldn't testify that it was the defendant, but the person in the Mr. Fay's vehicle blew through that red light and smashed right into her. So I would submit to your honors that based upon the evidence in this case, even if this court does find that that comment was inflammatory, it doesn't rise to the level of overturning the conviction in this case.
We're getting to a time where there's body cams now, too, and more. Yes. And more video. At what point does the court allow the state to disparage and inflame juries with that type of verbiage?
I believe Justice Hardesty also cautioned a prosecutor from Northern Nevada regarding very similar commentary. And I think that those comments were well taken. I think that we would be probably having a different conversation if they had been objected to at trial, but they weren't. And so in looking at the full context of the trial itself, in this particular case, I would suggest to your honors that there's not enough here to overturn the verdict. I do believe that Justice Hardesty in, I think it was Valdez, indicated that if the guilt is close, comments such as the one made by my co-counsel could in fact result in overturning the verdict. But the issue in this case wasn't close, your honor. There was, as I indicated, ample testimony, video evidence, and the state is not suggesting that body camera footage will alleviate the state from maintaining professionalism and decorum. That is certainly not the case. But I would suggest to your honors that based upon the evidence in this case, even if the court finds that that comment was error or inflammatory, it doesn't rise to the level of plain error.
Ms. Baharoff, I'd like to pose a question to you that's relevant to this case, and like my question to Mr. Water, would you please address the issue of whether the jury instructions for grand larceny and petty larceny as lesser included offenses should have been addressed?
Yes, of course. My understanding at the time we were settling jury instructions is that counsel was requesting a larceny from the person instruction, not a simple larceny instruction, because a simple larceny instruction was actually given based upon the definition of burglary. So that instruction was included in the packets. The instruction that's listed for this court, I believe it's under, I think the jury instruction is on page 705 of their appendix. That jury instruction included the definition of larceny, but the argument for that instruction was larceny from the person. So at the time that everybody was addressing that instruction and the instructions provided by counsel, we were all under the impression we were talking about larceny from the person. At least I personally was under that impression. Even if we're talking about simple larceny, I would submit that that instruction was already given, so that wasn't a particular issue. But dealing with the lesser included offense of larceny, the verdict form included larceny from the person, so I will focus my comments on that. This court in Smith versus State dealt with very similar language to the language that's included in our larceny from the person statute, that language specifically being under circumstances not amounting to a burglary. In Nevada, the larceny from the person statute says under circumstances not amounting to a robbery. In Smith versus State, this court determined that the lower court had properly declined to include trespass as a lesser included offense based upon that language, as well as the language regarding vexing or annoying the owner of the residence. But based upon the legislature's 1989 amendment adding, under circumstances not amounting to a burglary, that indicated that that was not, that any conduct for a trespass was specifically precluded.
So let me try to clarify my question further.
Yes.
In Hodges' brief at 23, although Hodges was referring to larceny generally, he cited to the grand larceny statute and the petty larceny statute. And so the question was whether or not he was comparing the petty larceny and grand larceny statutes, which would require, as you know, a $650 valuation to be demonstrated. Would you comment on that, and did that come up at trial?
It did not come up at trial under my recollection. As I indicated, we were all under the impression we were talking about larceny from the person. That was also the crime that was used on the verdict form provided by the defense counsel. And in terms of value, the state did bring up a value component as it related to larceny from the person only. So I would submit to Your Honors that, yes, while the brief provided by appellant now talks about grand larceny and petty larceny, at the time we were talking about larceny from the person, grand larceny auto as a theory of defense instruction only, not a lesser included, and that was really where all of the arguments were focused on. So the district court did not have the opportunity to address larceny or grand larceny in general as a lesser included.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. But just going back to that, Your Honor, I would submit that Smith versus State, and which the state did cite, indicates that that language, circumstances not amounting to a burglary, therefore remove trespass as a lesser included of burglary. Larceny from the person has the very same language. Moreover, larceny from the person was amended in 1997 to include a value component as well. So while we have those types of requirements, the intent, the value component, in the larceny from the person, we don't have any of those things in robbery. And I would submit to you that because of the difference in the statute itself, that it does not constitute a lesser included offense, possibly a lesser related offense, but as this court determined in Peck versus State, the district court's not required to provide a lesser related offense instruction. Moving on now to the other comments that were made during closing, I would just like to point out to Your Honors that there was an allegation that the state burden shifted at the end of the argument when it was addressing the leaving the scene statute. At no point in time did the state say the defense never presented evidence of the driver's license, etc. The state actually was reading the jury instruction to the jury at that time and pointing out that there wasn't any evidence that the defendant had complied with that statute. That objection was actually preserved because they did object to that. But I would point out to Your Honors that there wasn't an intention of burden shifting. The state submits the record does not support the burden shifting argument that was made, and we'd ask Your Honors to decline to overrule the conviction based upon that. Moving to cumulative error at this point, there, as the court's well aware.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Before you hit that one, what about the disparagement allegation in closing?
The disparagement? regarding the maniac comments?
No, not the maniac, where the state in closing says, argue all day if you want. Oh, blame, meaning Faye. That's what happens in these type of cases when there's overwhelming evidence. The defense wants you to do this and this, blame anybody other than the defendant. No, argue that all day long. It doesn't work. So they allege that that's disparagement, and that's part of when you're getting, before you get to cumulative error, that's part of
yes.
one of the errors that they're bringing up. What are your thoughts on that one?
I would submit to Your Honors that counsel, my co-counsel, was not attempting to disparage the defense at that point. He was making a commentary based upon the opening statements that were made, all of the questions that were occurring on cross-examination, and then preempting any arguments on closing argument by making those comments. But even if this court were to find, again, that that was error, I would submit to Your Honors that those comments themselves, in light of the fact that counsel then, in closing, did argue there was not enough evidence to support these conclusions, that it did not rise to the level of error sufficient to overturn the verdict. I would also point out to your honors that when counsel was making those arguments, he was objecting specifically to the same facts I indicated before, which was the behavior on the video and the driving through the lights and the robbing the victim on video. And so there was a possibility that Mr. Fay was being objected to as opening the door himself, and on cross-examination of Mr. Fay, some questions had been asked of him that, didn't you actually open the door yourself and get out of the vehicle? And in that particular case, I would submit to your honors that my co-counsel was commenting on an allegation that Mr. Fay maybe should have stayed in that car, and so that would be blaming Mr. Fay for what ultimately happened to him, which was the force or violence used upon him to take his vehicle after that. So I would submit to your honors that that was fair comment on the evidence based upon the questions to Mr. Fay. But even if you find error, I will submit to your honors that based upon the overwhelming evidence of this particular case, it does not rise to the level to overturn the verdict. Do you have any additional questions about those issues of error? No? Okay. So moving on to cumulative error now. As I indicated to your honors, the issue of guilt was not close. This is a rare instance where the crime is completely on video. All of the charges were demonstrated on video. We did have supporting evidence from witnesses who were able to come in and testify about what they saw, and their testimony was consistent with force or violence used upon Mr. Fay to take the vehicle. That vehicle was then removed from that area at a very fast pace, running through red lights, and then within 10 minutes, that vehicle came back at a very fast pace, running through a red light, and smashed into Naveed Lopez's van. The driver of that vehicle hopped out. The defendant was found a short distance from there within 4 minutes of that particular crash. Then the second issue is, of course, the quantity and character of the error. If this court determines that those two statements made by my co-counsel were error, I would still submit to your honors that those two statements alone, in light of the overwhelming evidence, do not require overturning the conviction of this particular defendant. There, as again, the issue of guilt is not close. There was overwhelming evidence. And, of course, the gravity of the crime charged, the state does not dispute that these charges were grave, especially the leaving the scene and the robbery charges. They have very high punishments and penalties that are facing the defendant, so we're not disputing that that element would have been met. But I would submit to your honors that since the issue of guilt was so very not close, that the state met its burden and that the court should affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple of things to clarify really quickly. I am 99.999% sure that larceny from the person was not in the verdict form. And the only reason I will not say I'm 100% sure is because I don't have the appendix in front of me. But I am fairly confident that larceny from the person was not on the verdict form. That was not an option. In fact, Hodges' attorneys didn't ask for larceny from the person as a lesser at trial. What happened was they asked for larceny as a lesser. On appeal, I had litigated under Lisby that because it seemed more like a larceny from the person, that the court had a sua sponte obligation to instruct on larceny from the person. So with all due respect to Ms. Baraja, that's just not true. It's factually inaccurate, number one. Number two, yes, there was a definition of larceny given because the state charged burglary, which included like one of the theories that he entered with the intent to commit larceny, but that's not the point in a lesser-included offense analysis. The reason in lesser-included offenses, you get it on the verdict form. So the fact that they were instructed on it means nothing if the jury doesn't have the option of convicting them of that. Number three, larceny from the person, the statute does say under circumstances not amounting to robbery. Now, they can analogize that to Smith and Strader, which doesn't have anything to do with lessers, but they can analogize that to Smith. But Smith is a lot different because trespass has very distinct elements. You go on land, vex, annoy versus burglary. Larceny from the person basically is robbery without the force. It says, under circumstances not amounting to robbery. Well, what would the only circumstance be? It would be the force. So if that's the circumstance, then everything else is larceny from the person. Now, again, they didn't ask for that at trial. They asked for simple larceny. My concern was that this court on appeal would focus on an element or on the intent as elements of the charged offenses, recognizing that larceny does have the specific intent to permanently deprive. Worried about that, on appeal, I'm looking at it, I see larceny from the person as a more natural fit as a lesser. So what I did was, under Lisby, I said, you know, the court then had a sua sponte obligation because notwithstanding this argument that there was overwhelming evidence, you know, the video is, respectfully, according to my co-counsel, it's not that clear that there's one portion of the video where there is possibly Mr. Hodges swinging at Mr. Fay, but even a reasonable person could disagree about whether he's swinging at him or if he's merely kind of trying to defend himself.
Mr. Water, could I interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
Is your memory of the record that in arguing larceny as a lesser included, that petty or grand larceny, and as defined in those statutes, were discussed at trial? Because they're referenced in your opening brief, but I don't think they were addressed in trial. I think the focus was just on larceny, as I understood it.
I think Your Honor's correct. And I think what happened was they proposed an instruction on larceny, just defining larceny without necessarily getting into value. But the state did object at trial, saying that value was an element of larceny, whereas value is not an element of robbery, and therefore it's not a lesser included. As I pointed out in my brief, since the trial, Al-Talabi came out, where this court discussed things that enhance punishment being not necessarily elements, quote-unquote, for purposes of lesser-included offense analysis. And so on appeal, my argument was, since the value of the property in a larceny prosecution really just goes to punishment and enhances it to a C or a B felony from a misdemeanor versus, under the rationale of Al-Talabi, you could look at value in that sense as being not necessarily, it's certainly an element of the crime, but not for purposes of lesser included offense analysis. And so that's why I argued that on appeal. But yes, value did come up at trial, but it was in the sense the state said it was an element that robbery didn't contain.
Yep. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Okay. No problem. Thank you. And if there's no other questions, then I guess I'm done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. Then this case stands submitted. I want to thank both sides for their arguments and wish you well.